It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We learn about the potential harm to endangered species through crop acreage devoted to corn. That's a popular feedstock for producing ethanol, which is a renewable fuel. Colin with questions and comments about biofuel and biofuel crops, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Tyler Lark is a lead scientist at the Center for Sustainability and the Global Environment at UW-Madison. His new policy analysis is in the journal Biological Conservation. Tyler, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks so much for having me again.
Well, lay it out for us. How is the mass production of ethanol affecting sensitive habitats?
Well, the connection is sort of just as you'd imagine. When we increase demand for ethanol and a product that uses a lot of corn, our landscapes, our farmers respond. We meet that need. We plant more corn, but oftentimes that comes at the cost of habitat. And so it's not really surprising that there's an interaction here. And what we want to do is just be cognizant of that and see if there's ways that where we can mitigate that potential harm.
And is the corn crop the primary issue here, or are there other biofuel crops contributing to the problem?
Yeah, right now, the way this policy is set up, it's the federal renewable fuel standard. Corn ethanol is really the number one biofuel that we produce. And so pretty much everything is coming from corn. And there's calls and interest in shifting away towards more advanced renewable biofuels. But right now it's predominantly corn.
And how much corn does it take to make ethanol? How much of that crop is really contributing to the ethanol industry, if you will?
Well, it's a big piece of agriculture, and our corn crop right now covers anywhere from 80 to 90 million acres of land across the country, and somewhere in the range of 25 to 40% of that gets used for fuel ethanol each year.
Turning to wildlife and species, which endangered species are particularly vulnerable to ethanol production?
Well, there's a whole bunch, a few that we looked at for this study. It really runs the gamut, things from small insects and pollinators up to larger birds and mammals as well as something we often don't think about as aquatic species, things that rely on clean and clear water that might be impacted by nutrient pollution, for example.
Oh, like in the Gulf of Mexico, for instance.
Yeah, right. So we know a lot of our fertilizer that we apply to our farmlands and that we need to produce this food. Unfortunately, we lose a lot of it to the environment as well, and it runs downstream and eventually ends up, if not deposited somewhere else, in the Gulf of Mexico.
So as these lands turn over to corn, it means that wildlife have less and less habitat to be able to live. Is that the primary concern here?
Yeah, so anytime we're expanding production of a single crop, so say corn in this example, there's kind of two ways to do that. We can either switch other crops to corn. So that would be, growing less wheat in Wisconsin, growing less alfalfa, a really valuable crop for our dairy herd, and planting more corn. And in that case, corn is just often a really intensive crop. It requires a lot of fertilizer, and the production and application of that fertilizer results in a lot of greenhouse gas or carbon pollution. And on the other side, you can get more corn by bringing more land into production, and oftentimes that comes at the cost of things like perennial grass pasture that may have been used for grazing or other types of conservation grasslands.
Which is where you bring in, for instance, butterflies and whooping cranes. What are you finding when that lack of habitat isn't there? What connection can you make that it is having an impact?
Yeah, all sorts of potential pathways here. So it's not hard to imagine a bird species or an insect, say a pollinator, something like the rusty patch bumblebee, something found right here in Wisconsin, that needs some of these floral resources. So the nectar, the pollen, to survive as a food source. And those usually come in locations of grasslands or, open fields where there's a diverse mixture of plant species growing and flowering plants that they need. And when you replace that with, say, a monoculture crop, and particularly one that doesn't have a lot of diverse plant life within its boundaries often, that just reduces those resources that a lot of these species rely on.
We're looking at the impact of ethanol production and particularly the impact on wildlife. UW-Madison scientist Tyler Lark, our guide. You can join in with your questions and comments at 800-642-1234. So turning to the renewable fuel standard, Congress establishes it in 2005, expands it in 2007, and this mandate that all transportation fuel must include a minimum volume of renewable fuel. What environmental concerns is this standard meant to address?
Well, initially, I think it came at a time, you know, about 15 years ago when there was a lot of concerns about energy independence, right? So a heavy reliance on petroleum and oil products from the Middle East and elsewhere. And it's still a case, right? We need to move away from petroleum-based and fossil fuels as soon as possible. And you know, nothing about corn ethanol says that we should continue with fossil fuels. But we want to be thoughtful about how we shift away and do that in the best way possible. And so that's where these renewable fuels come in and where this policy came in both in advancing energy independence. But I think the goal was also to try to get some environmental benefits. And we've just seen over the course of the 15 years that it's played out, a lot of the land use changes that can come with the additional need to produce all this extra corn for one single crop and one single fuel had a lot of environmental side effects. And so if there are ways to mitigate those, I think that's the direction that we really want to move going forwards.
A farm is a business, and it, to me, is conceivable that the farmer grows the highest value crop in response to market prices. They have to make choices that make economic sense as well. How is the renewable fuel standard affecting those decisions, perhaps with implications on wildlife conservation and other environmental pressures?
I think it's playing a big role. And you bring up a great point that it's definitely not, you know, it's not the consumers at the pump who are choosing one blend of fuel over the others. And it's definitely not our farmers who are managing and stewarding our lands and the landscape. Often it's the policies, right? And so the policy in this case, this renewable fuel or federal ethanol mandate, is driving these decisions. And so we've seen through our research that it increases the price of crops, especially corn, but other crops as well. And that then drives these changes that we can observe on the landscape.
Putting two agencies together here, the Environmental Protection Agency implements the renewable fuel standard. U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service entrusted to protect animals listed as endangered. Do these agencies collaborate on regulating biofuel production?
Right now, I think not to the extent that they could. So there's been, my understanding, some initial discussions. And really what this research says is, hey, there's a lot of potential for interaction here and a lot of opportunity. So if we pull these experts in, folks from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service who study and know and understand these imperiled wildlife and wildlife at large, can we modify this fuel policy that's implemented by the EPA and do so in a way that we can meet, you know, our energy production goals while doing it without jeopardizing or compromising the environment?
We have scientist Tyler Lark studies land use at UW-Madison Center for Sustainability and the Global Environment as we take a closer look at ethanol production and corn crops. Call in with your questions, your comments about corn-based ethanol, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could be here as we examine corn ethanol production, biofuels policy, and potential harmful impacts to wildlife conservation. A new journal article finds limited research in this area offers some solutions we'll get into. Call in with questions and comments, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Tyler Lark is lead scientist at the Global Land Use and Environment Laboratory of UW-Madison. Let's bring in Bill in Barnes. Bill, hi. What would you like to bring up?
Good morning. So we're putting corn in our gas tanks because it's better than oil. But when you consider all the energy inputs to produce that ethanol, of fuel to run the tractors, to apply the herbicides, to manufacture the herbicides, to dry the grain, to distill it into alcohol, when the total system of energy inputs is considered, what's the net gain of us essentially putting corn in our gas tank?
Bill, thanks for that question, Tyler.
That's a really good question, and a question people have been looking at now for quite some time, especially that we've upped our investment in ethanol. And all those things, as you mentioned, contribute to this overall climate pollution profile or greenhouse gas emission profile of the fuel. And at the end of the day, when you include all those, it comes out a lot closer than we think. So there's a lot of variance depending on where you grow it and how you grow it. Some studies say corn ethanol is 20% better. Others say it's 20% worse as far as greenhouse gas emissions relative to gasoline. And so, you know, it's sort of a wash there. And that's where I think we have to think about if we're going to have a lot of this fuel, we want to do it in a way that's not also degrading our environment in other dimensions.
Let's look at reducing harm, focusing on potential solutions. What practices would help reduce harm to nearby wildlife?
Yeah, so the great thing is we have a whole set of tools available right now that can help address this. And so conservation agricultural practices, if we're thinking about water quality and we want to have, you know, clean, clear water for habitat for wildlife and for us as humans, as a species as well, practices like putting cover crops on our fields or using conservation tillage practices, things that will reduce the amount of runoff and erosion and contributions to water impairment is a great, easy first step and something that a lot of farmers are already familiar with and know how to do. And so just tying some of those conservation practices to these mandates and other incentives and policies that are in place could go a long ways in reducing some of the environmental impacts.
What about like timing the harvest so it might occur outside a sensitive wildlife nesting season?
Yep, that could be another one, especially as we look towards some of these more advanced biofuels that might be, you can imagine something if we could create a fuel from a native and a perennial grassland and harvest that grass rather than having to plant intensive rows of corn and fertilize it really intensively. There's a lot of potential and excitement there, and you could also manage it in a way that provided great nesting and breeding habitat for these threatened and endangered species, while also providing a really productive product for society and for farmers as well.
And so that might be like a second and third generation fuel, whereas corn and soybeans would be a first generation biofuel?
Yep, exactly.
Okay, let's take another call now. Charlie with us in Beaver Dam. Charlie, what's on your mind?
I'm just saying about land use there on Highway 175 and 49. They're taking over 400 acres and putting it into solar panels. Highway B, just outside of Beaver Dam, they're taking hundreds and another hundreds of acres and putting it into solar panels. It's perfectly good farmland, and then they're taking it and putting solar panels. I was told the one on B is a 50-year lease. So that means that land's going to be out of production for a minimum of 50 years.
Charlie, thank you for that observation. And the role of solar farms here, what impact that can have to not only crop rotations but to wildlife, Tyler?
Charlie brings up a great point. And so our farmers right now and our land managers are feeling pressures from all sorts of dimensions, right? We have continued urban sprawl and development. We have alternative and renewable energy sources like solar photovoltaic systems that we want to get up. And so they're feeling the crunch from all sides. And so just like with renewable fuels and corn ethanol, we want to be thoughtful, I think, in how we site things like solar panels. And so there's emerging concepts, this idea of agrivoltaics. Can we integrate those solar panels on our landscape in a way that they're not going on our prime farmland, but maybe they're, you know, working on the marginal lands that are a little bit less productive and perhaps even integrated with agricultural production? So you can envision maybe grazing sheep underneath the solar panels or intermixing them with crops in a way that was co-beneficial for temperature regulation or water conservation. And so I think actually that solar panel and the expansion of solar production is a huge opportunity, but we, just like with renewable fuels, we want to do it thoughtfully and with some reflection and doing it in a way that can support farmers and our agricultural industry rather than really squeeze them out, which, you know, can be the case in sometimes.
I hear hints of what of being intentional about what we do to these lands and real dual purpose in ensuring a crop can do multiple things and have multiple benefits. Is that where you really would like to push the research?
I think you just put it in words better than I could myself. Yeah, dual purpose, right? Agriculture, we get a lot from it. It's really valuable for production, for society, and for food production in particular for us. But we can also ask more of it and get conservation benefits out of it, or renewable energy production out of it, whether it be through solar or other types of biofuels.
Suburban sprawl, also such an issue, you know, transforming large plots of undeveloped land and putting a crunch on wildlife habitats. How much attention should also be paid by city planners to the conservation of wildlife areas as these developments go in?
Well, we have, yeah, really one single land base, right? They always, the old adage is they're not making any more of it. We're not getting any more land. And so I think it's from all directions. It's at the urban fringe is a really important place to be thoughtful and think about, do we want to have these large sprawling subdivisions or large lot types of housing developments where you have to mow 5 acres of lawn? Or do we want to do it a little bit more densely and efficiently, which also then opens up opportunities for, you know, improved transit and mass transit and reduces the needs for fuels. So it all almost ties together in that sense of having, you know, smart growth in the urban areas and the urban fringe with smart land use in our rural landscapes of how we use our farmland for food and energy production.
Learning about food and energy production and the impact of ethanol production in the mix with UW-Madison scientist Tyler Lark. You can join in with your questions and comments at 800-642-1234. Returning now to the renewable fuel standard, a bit more policy here. Last year, we saw the Center for Biological Diversity suing the EPA over its implementation of the renewable fuel standard. And the conservation group says the federal agency has failed to assess how endangered species are impacted. How could, you know, be a solution coming out of the legal back and forth and the litigation?
Yeah, well, I think that probably plays a pretty important role. It's what it does is that I think it helps us dedicate resources to this. So it says, there's something going on here. This is an issue that we care about as society. These two policies, the Renewable Fuel Standard and the Endangered Species Act, are both two huge policies that have huge impacts on our landscapes and our livelihoods. And so getting those experts together in a room, the ones who know each of those policies intricately and say, how can these work together in a mutually beneficial way, I think only good can come of that. And so that's really what our research here that we're talking about today did. And that's what I think some of these legal questions and challenges that have come up are also trying to work towards.
There is this bipartisan group of Midwest governors and fuel industry leaders who are pushing the government to approve higher ethanol sales this summer. What do you make of that idea? And what is the impact of that on the environment?
Well, the research out there kind of suggests that really if that or any policy increases demand, specifically if we were, say, for U.S. corn ethanol, then it's likely that we're going to respond and bring additional land into corn production. And so we know that that then comes along with some of those additional carbon emissions and conversion of wildlife. And so if it increases demand for ethanol, that's the likely outcome. If it just sort of maintains it because there's a declining share of fuel use elsewhere, then the impacts probably aren't as severe.
I need to pick your brain about this. What happens to all this ethanol with EVs that are set to take over the road in the coming years, in the coming decades?
Yeah, well, it's, you know, it's going to be a slow ramp up probably. And there's always going to be some hard to electrify sectors. If we think of air travel or shipping overseas, or even heavy duty trucking in some cases. So there's probably a role for liquid transportation fuels for a while going forwards. And I think the question is, what proportion of that liquid fuel supply do we want coming from ethanol? And perhaps it will ramp up as gasoline ramps down and sort of replace it. I think an ideal situation would be it ramps up with better biofuels, ones that are more friendly on our landscapes, you know, based off of perennial and native plants. And it continues to probably be a part of that mixture. But as you say, as electric vehicles and more renewable fuels come online, or more renewable ways to produce that electricity come online, it'll continue to be a complement. And we just want to sort of balance that in the best way possible.
It's a balance. Tyler, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me back.
Tyler Lark, lead scientist at the Center for Sustainability in the Global Environment at UW-Madison. We have a link to his policy analysis at wpr.org/mornings. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.